day, everyone. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Rob Moore, here with Lauren Corman. Eventually, she's just gone out to get some water. And as always, the lovely Lamia Gibson at the helm of the show. Today we're talking with Jim Mason, author of The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. He wrote this with the controversial philosopher Peter Singer, as many of you know, author of Animal Liberation, and commonly referred to as the father of the animal rights movement in North America. We were going to start with news today, but unfortunately, as happens sometimes in the world we live in, sometimes we forget things at home, and so we can't actually go with what we planned to do. So I take full responsibility for actually forgetting the news.
But hopefully this will mean more time with Jim.
Yeah. A couple of, I can't even remember exactly what there was in the news, but one interesting thing was that Spain has introduced this new system in their legislation where companies that apply for tourist status, some kind of tourist status, actually have to now abide by animal welfare regulations. So I thought that was really interesting, but it said that the current bull run and the bullfighting where the lances, where they kill the bull with lances until the bull actually bleeds to death, and they and it's quite a popular sport in Spain, those kinds of things will be exempt from this animal welfare regulation. So I kind of thought that was kind of strange. Like, what would be the point of introducing these animal welfare regulations if they're not going to abide by them in the current tourist events that are happening right now? Thought it was interesting. But then there's this guy from PETA, this gay Irish guy from PETA, who's actually going to Madrid, I think, or Pamplona in July, and to do the running of the nudes. And they're going to do the bull run, but with a bunch of nude people doing the exact same run to sort of, you know, obviously support a much better event than trying to run a bull to death and kill him. So I thought that was those were two sort of interesting news items that I remember from today. But next week, come back and with a full news broadcast.
You know, I think it's more impressive if you do it by memory. I'd love yeah. to see. I'd love to see CBC do a whole newscast by memory.
Yeah.
You know, I think you should kick it up a notch and just start doing the show by memory. Today we're speaking with Jim Mason. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore. We're speaking about the book, The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. And this is co-authored with Peter Singer. Today we're speaking with Jim Mason. He's the author of many influential books. I've been a big fan of him for many years, been reading him when he started off with Peter Singer doing Animal Factories, and he went on. And he'd also written a book called The Unnatural Order. So it's a real pleasure and honor to speak with him today. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning. When I did the press release for the show, I was describing the book, of course, and I also said we're going to ask Jim what he had for breakfast today, because I assume a lot of people are curious about what you put in your mouth and what sustains you.
Well, I had a pretty big glass of orange juice with pulp and almond butter toast.
That sounds really good.
On whole wheat bread.
Very good.
Yeah.
So tell us about the way we eat, why our food choices matter. There's a lot of different food books out there right now. They're kind of proliferating. I was actually very interested to see that you you have Michael Pollan giving you the thumbs up on this book, considering he has a new book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, which in some ways seems kind of a little bit different than this book.
Yes. Well, I think the fact that there is a number of books, you may know them, of course, the Pollan book that you mentioned, and also Marion Nestle's book, What We Eat, which is more about food politics and the industry foibles and you know, enforcing food on us and obesity and those issues. And Jane Goodall had a book that was out some months ago. So I think what this shows is that there is quite a bit of consumer concern about the food system, which includes the farming system as well. I think the word is out now that factory farming and other industry practices, many of them really can't stand the light of day. And consumers are asking questions. They're looking at other options in food, like looking at organic foods. As you know, the sales of organic have just jumped up every year very steadily. So all of these books and all of this really seems to show a rising consumer concern about how our food's produced, and people want to know more.
So in terms of from a consumer's perspective then, you know, in this wash of new books about food, what distinguishes this book then, would you say, from those other books that you'd mentioned that are out there right now?
Well, our book is kind of scientific in a way, in that we actually looked at the concerns that were out there instead of just, designing and crafting a book that said what we want to say. We said, well, let's take a look and see what is the list of things that people are worried about with their food. And, of course, animal welfare issues are very big. As you know, they're some of the most emotional issues, the most difficult for people to get information about, because the information is not pleasant. But they're also, we found that they're concerned about chemicals in the food supply, environmental impact. There's a lot of controversy now about globalization and how that affects farmers and farm-working people in foreign countries. So we just looked at the whole range of concerns and decided that we would write a book about that, all of those, instead of just limiting it to the animal welfare concerns again, which we thought might just reach the same old audience of people that already know about these things, preaching to the choir, so to speak. So we wanted a book that had really a broad spectrum of ethical concerns, and in that we decided to eliminate the health issues for the most part. We do discuss obesity briefly in our book, how the food supply seems to foster obesity in people. But for the most part, we just wanted to look at the ethical problems in food production and see how our food choices really affect those.
It struck me at the beginning of the book where you talk about Morgan Spurlock and Super Size Me, and you said, you know, that type of film and the resulting, you know, books. I think he's written his own book. We had his partner on as well to talk about her book about this new American diet that she proposes, which is vegan. And you said, you know, these are you and Peter say, well, this is a good idea, and we're glad these books are out here. But there's enough of them. We're concerned in this book about how our choices, our food choices, affect others, and
that's
the emphasis
right.
is really on the others.
The others, and their others are all over the world, really. It's not just the farmer, you know, outside of town that's affected by this. We're looking at this. You know, globalization is the buzzword today, so we try to take a global perspective on where all the food comes from. And as you may know, we can discuss it further if you want. Some of our foods really travel quite a distance these days, you know, clear across continents to get to the supermarket. And so that needs to be discussed, too, in an age where we have problems with fossil fuels and energy conservation.
Well, Jim, maybe we can kind of summarize the book in that you followed three families and what they had in their kitchens, right? Three different families with three different diets.
It's a fantastic narrative approach. I wanted to say that I picked up this book last week to, you know, prepare for the interview, and I didn't expect that it would be a page turner, but because of this, the way that it's structured, you meet these families, you walk into their homes, you're opening up their cupboards, like you really feel like you're there with them, and then there's this sense of curiosity. Okay, well, now that they're learning more, what's going to happen now? You know, what types of questions are going to be raised? Are they going to change their consumption patterns? And also, very interesting, how do people think about their food choices? It's such an intimate book for something that I would have assumed would be sort of abstract.
Yes, thank you for that. Yes, that was actually a stroke of genius, I think, on Peter's part. He's such a genius, really, at designing a plan for a book. He just really knows how to package, I suppose is the word, how to package the material, which might otherwise be off-putting and boring and disturbing. So, yeah, we thought it would be fun to pick out three families with quite different kinds of diets. And that was quite a process in itself, finding those families.
Mm-hmm.
It took months and months to settle on the three families.
So tell us about the three families and their diets.
Okay. Well,
and tell us about how you chose, because I'm curious about that editing process.
How we chose them.
Yeah.
Well, we asked people that we knew, neighbors, friends, and relatives. You know, for example, I asked a cousin or a nephew, you know, to tell me the name of somebody that, that he or she knew that might want to cooperate in this book. So we asked relatives to ask neighbors. In one case, I asked personal friends, and they came up with a family that lived three houses down the block, and they were vegetarians. And so we did that, and we came up with a pool of about 20 families. And they sorted themselves out, actually, by attrition, because some of them cooperated for the first month or two, and then they sort of fell away. So we ended up with five or six families that were really enthusiastic about the project and really did their homework and replied to our questions and, you know, and basically shared everything with us. But that was too unwieldy. You can't write a book about six families. So Peter and I decided to, you know, to distill that down into three families with three very sharply different diets, and they are. The first family in Arkansas follows the standard American diet, which is, you know, basically supermarket and food chain restaurant of food, heavy and stacked toward animal products and fatty foods, and fried foods, and low fiber and processed sugar and flour, etc. You know, the basic standard American diet. The second family is what we call conscientious omnivores. It's interesting. The husband is a vegetarian for the most part, partial vegetarian in a way, because he does eat marine life on occasion.
So that means he's not a vegetarian.
He's not strictly a vegetarian, but he follows the vegetarian diet for the most part, unless there's a compelling reason to share some other food. And the wife and kids are meat eaters, eat animal products, but only when they're from, ethically concerned sources, such as free-range eggs, pasture, pork, humane systems, organic, all of that. And then the final family, the third family, are strict vegans, and they never depart from that diet. They strict vegans all the way, and much of their food is organic as well. So we had these three sharp categories and followed the foods that they ate. We worked with them by email and personal visits to come up with a list of the foods that they buy, whether they buy them at supermarkets or markets and cook at home, or whether they buy them when they go out to eat. And the fun was in tracing those foods back to the farms of origin. And we came up with a list of 87 companies, including McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken and some of the better-known organic producers like Organic Valley and Horizon and many of the companies that health food and organic people are familiar with. And we asked all of these companies, these 87 companies, to help us trace these food products back to the farm. And as you find out when you read the book, we had a miserable response. The first round, The first round of letters produced, you know, a trickle of replies. And so we actually got a couple of nasty phone calls. And one company left a message that I wish we could have repeated in the book. Another accused us of having a hidden agenda.
Right.
This is from the big corporations. The few, after a couple of these letters, the few that did respond were mostly the small mom-and-pop organic and free-range producers. And they were happy to have us in. One, in fact, invited us to come into their home and spend the night. So it was quite a revelation to us to see how, you know, the major food companies are willing to step aside from their advertising and their promotional material to actually show you the facts. And it's not a pretty sight.
Well, it seems to me, I mean, this is part of the irony, it seems, in terms of conventional agriculture, that I think that people who are concerned with some of these issues that you mentioned, like globalization and animal welfare and, you know, effects to the environment from their food choices, that you're in a position where I think that those concerns are often dismissed as being, you know, the concerns of city slickers, and that, you know, you couldn't possibly understand the food systems. But then if you're trying to figure out what actually happens within these corporations, if you trace all the, you know, the things down to you know, the earth that it's grown on and the animals that are there and the workers that are there, you often really can't gain access
Exactly.
To make those types of choices, and so you're sort of bound by your own ignorance. They don't really give you very much room to move.
Yes, they only tell you what they want you to hear, and that's in their fancy advertising. And some of the most outrageous, of course, is the advertising that's put out by the dairy products industries. If you see their TV commercials and the, you know, the images that they put forth, whether print or broadcast, they typically show happy cows dozing in the shade in the sunny field. And the fact is, as you may know, and your listeners may know, very few cows in the current U.S. and North American dairy industry, for that matter, live under those conditions. Most of them are in factory farms. So it's the packaging of information, very selective information they send out to people, that sends the rosiest image of the farms that produce their food. And then when you ask to see the actual places, they get very possessive all of a sudden. In fact, the most common response I got, and I'll give you an example, is Oscar Mayer. One of the families ate Oscar Mayer bacon or sausage or something. And I remember the morning I called the Oscar Mayer company, and by the way, try that sometime. That's quite right. An exercise in corporate telephone menus. Trying to find your way to someone who will talk to you. And then when I finally got a human being on the line, she was flabbergasted that I would ask the question, where does the bacon come from? Where are the pigs that are raised, will be slaughtered to produce this bacon? And there was this awful silence. And she actually told me, I guess she was kind of an amateur at the job and didn't know the protocols just yet. She said, mm-hmm. Well, I guess I don't know. I'll have to ask. And she said, you'll have to give me a couple of days. Well, obviously what happened is she went up the chain of command and talked to some vice presidents or somebody, and mm-hmm. Oscar Mayer is owned by Kraft Foods, and who knows, someone else probably owns Kraft Foods. After all of the corporate bureaucracy, the first message came back that this was proprietary information, mm-hmm. which means, you know, they basically don't have to tell you. It's proprietary. So that's just a good tip to people, your listeners who may not want to answer a question, just always say, well, it's proprietary.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like lets you off the hook and you don't have to go any further. But we got that response in a lot of places.
Jim, well, so were you able to get past these corporate walls and actually get to the information you wanted?
Well, yes, because, there are so many sources. For example, take Tyson Foods, which was one of the companies that didn't respond to anything that we sent out. There's tons of information about Tyson, which is the nation's largest chicken producer. I think they have a quarter of the entire U.S. market. They produce 2 billion chickens a year, and they go all over the place. So Tyson is so big, it's like McDonald's or somebody, that there's tons of information out there about them already. And, we looked at that information, whether we got it from books or from public record, like, for example, their violations of worker safety rules and other, you know, U.S. Meat Inspection regulations and so forth. We looked at all of that and did try to verify it with the company. You know, we'd get back to them and say, you know, is this, give us your response to this. And, of course, we'd get nothing. So that's how you get this information without. Then, of course, too, you know, I hate to use the cliche, but if you've seen one factory chicken farm, you've seen them all, because they're virtually identical. Mm. There's slight, very slight, virtually undetectable differences, maybe from southern chicken factories to extreme northern ones because of the difference in weather. But for the most part, the sheds are the same size, the crowding rate is the same. In fact, all of the chickens come from the same breeding stock, so you know, you don't have to go exactly into a Tyson chicken shed to know how Tyson chickens are produced, because you can go into other sheds and be fairly confident that the methods and the techniques are the same all over. Mm.
The confinement systems, I assume, haven't changed that much since you did Animal Factories with Peter Singer. What was it like to revisit these issues? I mean, I know that you've been looking at them since that time. on your own, but to revisit them in terms of writing a book again, was it sort of depressing to see things haven't really changed?
No, they've changed at all. They've changed for the worse in the sense that there's more animals confined to factory systems. Like, just take pigs, for example. When we researched animal factories in 1975, which is over 30 years ago, there were some over 600,000, I guess the figure is 660,000 pig farms produced only about 69 million pigs. 90% of those disappeared over the years, over the 30 years, so that a couple of years ago there were only 69,000 pig farms producing 103 million pigs, so it's like a tenth of the farms producing 1.5 times as many pigs. And the reason for that is because of the corporate takeover of pig production. The elimination of factory pig farms by large corporate producers that have huge, huge factory compounds where they have thousands of breeding cells in one location. And the same thing has happened to the dairy business. When we researched animal factories in the 70s, there were, I don't have the number, but there were a large number of family-type farms that had, you know, large herd with 300 or 400 cows, and they were centered mostly in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. And in the course of 30 years, the center of dairy production has shifted entirely to the West. And now California is the number one dairy state. And most of the dairy farms, if you want to call them that, factories in California are huge with thousands and thousands of cows and kept in dirt lots. So the change has been for the worst in terms of the corporate takeover, the crowding levels, the size in terms of numbers of animals in one place. Just quite a bit more intensive than it was even in the 70s.
So, I mean, I imagine for our listeners, although they're, you know, they're diverse in terms of their perspectives, and we have people who are animal activists that listen to the show, but, you know, just the general listener as well, and I think most people listening to your description of these animal factories would say, you know, of course this sounds horrible. I don't want to participate in that, but there's expenses to consider, there's convenience to consider. You know, I think a lot of people are leaning towards thinking about humanely, what is termed humanely raised meats or free-range eggs and that type of thing. And I was really fascinated to read what you had to say about these sort of alternatives, and I was wondering if you could share some of your insights about those sort of alternative meats and alternative dairy that people are looking towards to get away from the animal factory products.
Okay, that's a good one. Yes, that's the first response that we're getting from the book, from family members and friends who are reading it who are still not quite vegetarian or vegan or animal concerned, and they say, my gosh, what can I do? I mean, I don't know where to buy that stuff. They don't know what to do, and I think what people should try to do in most cities and suburban areas, there are so-called health food stores or alternative food stores in local farms and local markets. They should look to those. There's, you know, with a little bit of amateur research, you can find out about local food, people concerned about food groups and food choice groups and consumer groups and so forth. And you can find, in the Yellow Pages, you can find out about alternative food stores and food sources. There's a lot of stuff available that can be bought online, for example. If you don't have a health food store locally, you can buy bulk organic grains and so forth. Sometimes they're delivered. So that's one thing they can do, is just really look for other places to buy food. The other thing, the objection we get is the price. Someone who's used to going to the supermarket is buying eggs, or say, down here you can buy them sometimes as cheap as $1 a dozen in the supermarket. And, of course, they're factory eggs from chickens that are crowded in cages, and that's why they're cheap, because they cut production costs to the bare bone. And then they want to buy alternative eggs, free-range eggs, that is, eggs from chickens not confined to cages, and they find that they're $2, $3, $4 a dozen, and, you know, they go, ouch, I can't afford that. And what we say is, well, look, what you're doing when you buy the cheap eggs is you're basically passing along the cost of production to someone else. Like the people who live in the vicinity of a factory egg farm have to put up with flies and smells and manure that's dumped and the cost of environmental cleanup and all of those things are not reflected in the price of the eggs. So you're really cheating when you buy those cheap eggs. If you buy, say, organic eggs or free-range eggs, there's a better chance that the full cost of production is reflected in that price. So it's a fairer price. And it's if you want to be a strict capitalist, as some people insist on being, supply and demand, you know, all those rules of the market, the free, the fair market and all that, then really to be true to your principles, you should buy the more expensive product, because that really is using the market the way it's intended to be used, which is to, you know, to include in your purchase price the true cost of production and not pass them on to someone else. That's false market mechanism when you do that. So, and I call those extra costs externalities. And that's the way big agribusiness and the major food companies keep the prices down. Not only do they cut corners with environmental concerns, but as you may know, with workers' rights and workers' safety in the chicken industry, the factory chicken industry is notorious for using illegal workers, undocumented workers, and a high turnover and low pay and no benefits and horrendous conditions in the workplace. So. Again, there's some cheating going on there when you buy those products because they're cheaper.
Jim, we're going to take a short break. I want to come back and talk about some of the nitty-gritty of free-range and humane meats, that's in quotes, and organics, because there's a lot of confusion about what those different terms mean, and I was hoping you could clear up some of that muddiness for us. So we're going to come back, we're going to play an ad and play a little bit of music, and then come back with our interview with Jim Mason. We're speaking about the new book, The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter, and they certainly do. Please stay tuned to Animal Voices. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. Our show, Animal Voices, is archived every week on our website, animalvoices.ca. So if you miss part of this program or you want to pass it along to a friend, you can download over 150 shows now from our website, animalvoices.ca. I wanted to encourage people, too, to write into us if you have favorite shows. We're going to do a feature section where people can post their favorite shows and just let people know who are coming to the site maybe for the first time what some of the best programs are, so they have a place to start, because it's kind of overwhelming. It's a pretty big site with a lot of different content. Today we're speaking with Jim Mason. We're speaking about the book The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. This is co-authored with Peter Singer, author of Animal Liberation. But Jim himself is obviously very well known too within the animal movements and beyond as being both in a human rights, I don't know if he uses that term, but concerned with human issues as well as environmental issues. He's an attorney and an activist. We're very pleased to have him on the program today. Before the break, we were speaking a little bit about organics and free range, and I was also mentioning this term humane meats, and I wanted to do a little bit of clarification about some of those terms, because they are certainly confusing, and we were hoping that Jim could clarify that for us. So Jim, welcome back to the program.
Okay, yes.
So tell us about those terms. What do they actually mean, and what do they actually mean for the people and the animals and the earth and everyone that's involved?
You know, I have to give you a straight answer right off. The terms are confusing to everybody, even the people that are trying to clear them up.
Right.
Organic is being slowly but surely sort of nailed down, so to speak. There's now, like, at least in the U.S., there's a U.S. government definition of organic, and it's being consolidated and supervised and sort of managed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this has been happening, been taking place, this process, over the past few years. And there's continuing struggles over what that includes. Big agribusiness, of course, wants to get in on the market, and they would like to stretch the definition a little bit to allow them to continue some of their practices. Best example recently was the big flap in the organic milk business over Horizon, wanting to have what is essentially a dairy factory. I think it was in the Dakotas somewhere, where they had thousands of cows that were kept under virtually factory-type conditions. the only difference being they were fed organic grains. And a lot of the, you know, traditional organic people raised heck about this because they thought it was really going to dilute and distort and destroy the whole image, the whole reason consumers buy organic in the first place. And the outcome of it was that, you know, they had to rearrange their principles a little bit. They had to, what came out of it was they have to guarantee animals access to the outdoors, and, you know, to pasture and things like that. So organic is being slowly but surely made to be a more firm definition that, you know, got some harmony to it and some reliability to it. Because before you had varying standards from state to state, and the consumer could never know whether they were getting, you know, a good organic product or not. So organic is being straightened out. As for the other terms, free range and humane, this, there really isn't any official definition of these terms. They're used by various companies to kind of, you know, put a nice spin on their product. For example, you can go to the supermarket and see, or at least the food store and see free-range eggs or humane meat or something like that. Well, there isn't any official government definition of that yet. It's these are terms in the trade, and they don't always mean what you think they might mean. For example, free-range eggs, you would think you'd get this image of chickens running around, you know, pecking insects and running free in the pasture and all that, and that's not necessarily the case. There may be some farms like that, but most of the free-range eggs and the organic eggs, for that matter, are raised in sheds. And it's just that the birds are not in cages. They're crowded on an open floor that sometimes they look almost like a broiler shed inside. And if you remember that part of the book where Peter visited an organic egg farm in New Hampshire, I believe it was, he was kind of shocked when he went into the building to see these chickens, these hens that produce free-range organic eggs. And that particular producer didn't even allow his birds access to the outdoors, claiming that there was a fear of the spread of bird flu. Mm. So, you know, I'm sorry to confuse the listeners, but that's just the way it is right now in the industry. It's confusing. It's conflicting information about what these terms mean, and they're not really officially defined yet.
I think a lot of people assume that organic means humane, that they sort of see them as synonyms.
Well, I think they do. The organic industry is trying to include humane concerns more and more. For example, this issue about animals having access to the outdoors was an important one because it shows that there is an animal welfare concern being voiced in the organic industry, and their voices are being heard. And they're being reflected in, you know, whatever changes are being made to the U.S. Department of Agriculture rules and regulations. Just by virtue of, you know, the realities of organic farming, the animals would sort of necessarily be kept under relatively better conditions because the organic farmers can't use the shortcuts of antibiotics and drugs. In factory farming, you know, you can keep sick cows in a factory and, you know, dose them with hormones and drugs and growth hormones and antibiotics and kind of keep them producing milk, but an organic farmer can't use those things. So they would have to kind of keep their animals under relatively less inhumane conditions to get those cows to, you know, to produce milk. So it's a relatively better buy to buy organic milk and eggs than it would be a regular supermarket unlabeled product because there's just a good chance that the animals have to be treated a little bit better because they don't have the shortcuts of the antibiotics and drugs.
But the slaughter issues are the same, I suppose.
I'm sorry?
The slaughter issues and the transportation.
That's the thing, yeah. We'll get to those in a minute. But let's talk about humane. I mean, the word humane means a lot to those of us who are animal people, but in the marketplace out there, it's virtually without definition so far. There's no official definition of what's a humane farm. So what might be humane to one person is inhumane to another. We would say that there's a good chance that it's a relatively less inhumane farm if the animals are kept in smaller numbers, have access to the outdoors, have freedom of movement, things like that. Sometimes the product might be labeled pasture raised or something like that. And that's helpful because you know that those animals are going to have access to the outdoors and freedom of movement. So you just have to kind of look for other clues in the label. Now, what you mentioned about transportation and slaughter, yes, that's a whole big issue. Now, that's a relatively small part of the production process in terms of the animal's lifetime. It occurs at the very end, of course. But humanely raised pigs in one of the farms that we discuss in the book had these nice, well, for a pig farm, they were nice places for pigs. The pigs were living outdoors. And they had shelter, of course, but they had pasture and they had plenty of space. But when time came to go to market, they were sent quite a distance away, several states away, to a slaughter plant. And they had to be shipped just like any other slaughter pigs would be shipped, packed into trucks and kept in there for hours and hours without food and water or a chance to stretch their legs. And then, of course, they end up at a slaughter plant. And procedure there, of course, is not a heck of a lot different than it would be in a big factory farm type slaughter plant. Maybe the numbers would be somewhat smaller. Numbers slaughtered that day might be a few slight changes, but there are just so few slaughter plants left now that it's just like it is with the factory farms. They're virtually all alike. They're heavily mechanized, and the labor costs are very high, and so the animals, so the numbers of animals that move through there have to be kept moving at a pretty fast speed in order to make the whole thing profitable. So slaughter is still, you know, really the remaining issue for so-called humanely raised meat.
Jim, I'd like you to get back to more of a summary of the book in terms of those three families that you mentioned.
Okay.
And I'd like you to kind of summarize, if you could, kind of quickly, the findings of each family and how and where the food was traced to, and perhaps some of the more surprising results that you found.
Okay.
Because well, I think there are some presumptions that come with that. Like, oh, this will be bad, this will be great.
Yes.
So if we could clear that up.
Well, in the case of fish, it was very interesting. Our family in Arkansas that didn't have a lot of food choices other than the local Walmart bought some kind of fish fillet, and when we traced it, we found out that the fish in question was pollock, which is turned out by coincidence that it's one of the few sustainable fisheries left. It's on the fish list, and for people who want to trace environmentally conscious or, you know, ecologically conscious choices with so-called seafood or marine life or fish, look at the website www.thefishlist.com, and it will give you a list of the sustainable fisheries, of which pollock was one. And the methods by which they harvest the pollock fish in the northern Pacific are fairly humane and sustainable relative to other places where the fish are being depleted and where the huge nets and the catching methods they use are quite disturbing to the ocean environment. For example, there's a matter of bycatch, which is a horrible term that refers to the numbers of unwanted sea creatures that are caught up in these nets that are literally thrown away on the decks of the boat. Sometimes they die in the process. But the pollock fishery, because of the way the schools of fish congregate, they get a pretty, pardon the expression, a clean sweep, and they don't get a huge bycatch, and the nets don't touch the ocean floor. So here's this family that really doesn't exercise any ethical choices for a lot of reasons, and yet they ended up with a fairly ethical choice in seafood. By contrast, the conscientious omnivore family was trying to buy ethically proper products, and it turns out that one of the fish products they bought, I think it was salmon, turned out to be factory farmed in the ocean coastal regions off Norway. I think it was advertised as Norwegian smoked salmon or something like that. And here they tried to do the right thing, and yet it turned out that the fish that they bought came from really bad practices. And those salmon factories offshore, coast of Europe, are really bad. They're like any other factory farm. They pollute the waters with feed, the fish meal that they dump in these places. They have these fish in huge cages that float in the ocean offshore. And, of course, they have to be fed because they can't feed themselves. They're like factory chickens. And when they dump the feed in the water, it causes pollution, and there's a diseases in the salmon because of the close confinement. So that was one of the interesting twists that we found. Like you say, you would presume that this conscientious family would always make the right choices, but not necessarily so.
And then what about the vegans? Tell me what surprised you about the vegans. I mean, were they the best overall?
Well, can
I phrase it like that, the best overall? Did they make the best choices overall?
Sure. I think if you could find some numerical method, you know, to quantify their choices and measure them against the impact on the environment, the vegan family obviously had the best diet, the most strict diet. Just take energy conservation, for example. There was a study that was mentioned in New Scientist magazine a month or so ago that compared the energy cost of a vegan diet to the energy cost of someone that buys, like, one of these hybrid cars, like the Prius or Prius. And they found out that the vegan would actually save 1.5 times as much fossil fuels as the person who buys the hybrid car. So it's not enough just to buy an energy-efficient automobile. You could also adopt an energy-efficient diet, which the vegan diet is the best because it doesn't use wasteful animal products, all of which are wasteful because it takes so much fossil fuel to grow the grain and it takes to feed the animals, and there's so much waste in the process of digestion and metabolism of the nutrients in those plant foods. So there's just a lot lost, a lot of energy wasted and lost in the process of putting meat on the hoof. So the vegan family, and especially where animal welfare issues are concerned, you know, clearly the vegan family was completely clean, had a clean record when it came to animal concerns because, of course, they didn't eat any animal products at all. We actually didn't find any products that the vegan family used that were bad or tarnished in any way because they were so careful. Now, they could have bought the wrong chocolate if you want to get into human concerns. If people aren't concerned about where their coffee or their chocolate comes from, it could be that those foods are produced, you know, in places where there are oppressive governments, where there may be child slavery, as is in the case with chocolate. Some really bad practices that can occur even with the ostensibly vegan product. So you have to be careful even if you are a vegan, because you might cause some impact, some unintended impact somewhere else.
And you also mentioned that perhaps buying locally is not the best thing either. Could you talk about that?
I imagine that's quite a controversial point.
Yes, I think it is.
Now, you know, I'm sorry for the listeners out there. Like, I should caution them that don't get upset and overwhelmed by all of these conflicts. I know people who would just throw up their hands and say...
That's what I was going to ask you about as well.
Yeah, oh my God.
Where do I start? Oh no.
Oh my God, this is impossible. I can't do this. You know, like if I try to make this choice, then I end up violating some other concern and, you know, maybe they all just cancel out and I'll just, you know, eat what I've been eating for all these years and hope for the best. That is unfortunate that happened. Like, let's take the case of the local food. The example we gave in the book was tomatoes. Our conscientious omnivore family lives in Connecticut, and they buy from a nice local farm, very interesting farm. It's been in the same family name for 17 generations. This farm goes back to the late 1600s in Connecticut, and the Sherwood family still raises food there and sells it in season at their farmer's market, and the Matavalli family goes up there in the summertime to buy tomatoes. Now, this farmer likes to get a jump on the season, and he raises a crop of tomatoes that come out a month early. And to do this, he has to start them in a greenhouse. And to keep them warm in the early spring months, he has to use fossil fuels to heat his greenhouse. So Peter and I did some math, and we figured out, okay, how much fossil fuel does he consume in order to produce a ton of tomatoes? So instead of boring you with the exact figures, let's just say that he uses, you know, 100 gallons of fossil fuel to raise a ton of tomatoes. And we looked at what does it cost to ship the same ton of tomatoes up from Florida, where they grow in the natural sunshine, without any additional energy costs. We found out that, you know, oddly enough and regrettably, it's cheaper to bring in the tomatoes from Florida than it is for the family to buy them locally. The energy cost of trucking them up here are actually less than the cost of raising them in a greenhouse. So in that case, we found, wow, these tomatoes, you really want to be, you know, energy conscious and environmentally conscious, you should not buy the local tomatoes. Well, okay, so a couple of chapters later, then we get into human rights issues and labor issues, and we found out that this same tomato-growing region in Florida has been cited, actually, some people have been sent to prison for slavery, convicted of slavery under the U.S. law for enslaving workers to work those tomato fields. So you just have to pick and choose your concerns and which ones are most important. In that case, the environmentally correct choice turned out to be a violation where human rights are concerned. Mm-hmm. And this is where, you know, as we said, people will throw up their hands and say, oh, my God, I just don't know what to do. And we would say, look, you know, this isn't the case with every food product. We just picked out a couple of extreme examples, like the case of the fish and the case of the tomato, to show you that things aren't always what they seem, that you do need to look further. And like rice was another example. We found out that if you live in California, you can buy local rice. And it costs so much a ton to produce that rice. And the methods in California are very energy intensive. They use heavy machinery. They use giant machines to level the rice fields. They use a lot of irrigation, et cetera, et cetera. We found out that it would actually be more environmentally conscious and healthier for the environment to actually ship in that rice by container ship from India or from Asia, where it can be produced under more natural methods. And so, you know, if you live in California, it would be a better choice to buy the imported rice because it's safer. But this isn't the case with every food product. We just had to pick out a few examples to show people that you do need to know more about the origins of your food and then, you know, pick and choose which of the concerns are more compelling to you, whether it's worker safety or environmental concerns or animal welfare.
Do you see the book as a bit of a handbook for thinking through some of these choices, you know, in a more kind of in-depth way?
Yes, that's what we ended up with. You know, there's been such a run of books in the past decade, this 101 things you can do to save the earth, or 10 steps to wealth and fame, or such and such for the complete idiot, or
right.
You know, computers for dummies. I mean, there's so much of these books that try to oversimplify everything. And what we came up with was a book that really doesn't oversimplify anything. If anything, I suppose a lot of people would say our book shows the complexities of the food production system and may tend to overwhelm some readers. But what we want to do in this book is basically start a thinking process, you know, get people to think and seek information and to do a little homework. And And we say to them, you know, in effect, we say, well, it ain't that easy because, number one, the food system is very complex, and the food companies don't give you very much information, and you may live in a place like our Arkansas family where you don't have a lot of choices. You know, you've got Walmart and not much else. So what we're trying to say is just do the best you can, you know, just learn more. You don't have to do it all today or tomorrow or next week. Pick out a couple of food items that are of particular concern to you, like milk. You know, everybody can buy organic milk somewhere now. It's in all the supermarkets, even in the boondocks. You can buy Horizon or Organic Valley milk. So that's a change that a lot of people can make. So it shouldn't be seen as overwhelming and too complicated. The point of it all is to get people to thinking and asking questions.
We have a minute left, and I just want to turn it over to you if you want to have a last pitch for the book or a message that you want to leave our listeners with, and of course tell us where we can get this book as well.
Well, first of all, the book is by Rodale Press, and most people in your audience will recognize the name Rodale as, you know, the great organic company, the pioneer of organic farming, and they have a website. They have many publications about alternative farming methods. So Rodale is a powerhouse, a place for information on organic and alternative farming methods and food products. And, of course, now they're a powerhouse publishing company as well. I think probably the most famous book they put out was The South Beach Diet, which is a bestseller. And, by the way, our book is now, The Way We Eat, is now a bestseller in Australia, on the bestseller list number 9.
Congratulations.
So it's getting around, and it's going to be published in Italy and in the United Kingdom, and it's being published in Brazil and Portugal and Spanish language, so it's going to go all over. And I guess the essential message is just what I said a moment ago, is that don't be confused and don't be overwhelmed. Just read about the realities of food production and make some a few better choices. And not everybody can go vegan overnight like some of us have.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can do a little something. And just start somewhere and do something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that vegans are often seen as, you know, people who are kind of high on themselves, that they're somehow, you know, holier than thou, that they've made these food choices. And I think this book is really good for sort of demystifying that, that it's really not about proving that you're better than someone else. It's about trying to, you know, live a conscious, ethical, compassionate lifestyle to the best of our abilities, you know, where we're at.
And it's, yeah, not, it's not about purity. It's about doing the best you can. And when you know better, you do better.
That's right. That's the bottom line with this book. And just, again, don't be confused and overwhelmed. Just start thinking.
Jim, it was such a pleasure to talk to you today. I've been a fan of your work for a really long time. I think I've read The Unnatural Order like 6 or 7 times now.
Well,
and
thank you.
I've worn thin my Animal Factories book. It's been essential for me to have this type of information. So I wanted to say thank you, and thank you for being on the program today.
Well, thanks for the time.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Jim Mason. He's the co-author of a new book called The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. This is co-authored with Peter Singer. If you have any questions or comments for Animal Voices or ideas about your favorite shows, send them in to animalvoices@ciut.fm. Thanks to Lamia for teching, Rob Moore for co-hosting today, and please stay tuned for Roadrunner on CIUT 89.5.